Oh, do we have a Hell Yeah Brother sound? Bennett?
No, I think Bennett's just always just been saying it. Hell Yeah Brother.
Hell Yeah Brother.
The neocons are taking another L. Mike Waltz is out of the National Security Advisor position. And we're going to be covering that with a J.D. Vance interview. Also, just so that we're not too full of white pills, because, you know, we keep it real around here.
We do.
Black pill from the north. Canada swings left. Again?
And again. I lost my bingo card. I think you did too, Dave.
Somebody
had Canada on there. It wasn't just me.
No.
Maybe it was just me.
I think it was just you. Mine was Ukraine overperforms, and it was like, they kind of did, but it was like, it was marginal. It wasn't like as big as I thought it would be. Sorry, Germany, not Ukraine.
Ukraine might overperform as well. I mean, with this new mineral deal, we'll find out.
Yeah, we'll see.
Anyways, welcome to another episode of Human Reaction, your weekly source for independent commentary on cultural news and politics. I'm joined by my usual suspects, David Rand and Kyle Mack. And we've got Bennett watching us from the rafters via the internet. Glad to have him in the room virtually.
And okay. If you want to support the show, leave some comments for us. Comment on all of our stuff. It drives the algorithm. If other people can feed rage comments, so can we.
That's right.
It really seems to be the thing that grows the podcast who's the best and recommends it to more people. And so if you want to start a fight in the comments, please do.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Just do that.
Because I'm pretty sure the Israel bots are doing that right now.
So. Yeah, right. The more you can fight an AI in our comments, the better the show does. It's the best way to support us.
You know, this is going to be the new 100 men versus a gorilla. It's going to be one man versus 100 bots in our comment section. So let's get it on.
Yeah, hell yeah.
All right.
Starting off, I just want to give you guys... you know, the Pope died, right? And I just wanted you guys to... get a feel for who the next pope could be. Like, this is a very big piece of our history of where we're going right now. Uh-huh. We may have some, and actually Lindsey Graham pitched an idea, but we have Lindsey Graham saying, I was excited to hear that President Trump is open to the idea of being the next pope.
What?
This would truly be a dark horse candidate, but I would ask the papal conclave and Catholic faithful to keep an open mind about this possibility. The first pope and U.S. president combination has many upsides. Watching for white smoke.
And they don't get that smoke.
And
I need to see this. Yeah, I need to see.
So unfortunately, it's like right next to the plane, so it's kind of bad audio. But you can get a feel of how this went down. A reporter asking him, "Who do you think the next pope should be?"
As pope, I'd like to be pope. That would be my number one choice. No, I don't know. I have no preference. I say we have a cardinal that happens to be out of a place called New York who's very good. So,
but
this is so weird because it's a Southern Baptist advocating for an agnostic to become pope. Right? I mean, he's pretty much...
this is the timeline we're on.
Yeah, that's what it is.
So
yeah.
There were prediction markets going. It was saying, does Trump suggest himself as next pope? And yes. It happened, and it has been fulfilled. So if you took that bet, you did well.
I need to get in on this, because I would have called that for sure.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things where it shows... It's so like instinctually how funny it is. No thinking, just who do you think the next pope should be? I would like to be.
Yeah, right. Obviously. Yeah, why not? That's how you win at life. Just be like, I could do that.
I can do that. People just do things, guys.
Look, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, right?
Exactly.
Trump lives by that philosophy.
That's right.
100%.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
Okay, so what's going on? So let's move on to Mike Waltz here. real news.
Yeah, all right. So J.D. Vance got an interview with Fox News talking about this move and kind of demonstrating the administrator's perspective on it. There's been a lot of speculation around it. I think it's a lot to unpack to really talk about the implications of it. So let's dive into the clip with J.D. Vance.
I want to start with the breaking news.
Yeah.
Why was Mike Waltz let go?
So he wasn't let go. He is being made ambassador to the United Nations, which, of course, is a Senate-confirmed position. I think you can make a good argument that it's a promotion. But we brought Mike on to do some serious reforms of the National Security Council. He has done that. I like Mike. I think he's a great guy. He's got the trust of both me and the president. But we also thought that he'd make a better UN ambassador as we get beyond this stage of the reforms that we've made to the National Security Council. You saw the president announce that Marco Rubio is going to step in as interim leader of the National Security Council. So I think the media wants to frame this as a firing. Donald Trump has fired a lot of people. He doesn't give them Senate-confirmed appointments afterwards. What he thinks is that Mike Waltz is going to better serve the administration, most importantly, the American people in that role, and I happen to agree with him.
But was it?
So is it a promotion? That's the question.
It's a really diplomatic way to frame it.
Yeah.
This is what happened to Nikki Haley. It wasn't like she just kind of got off to the side to the to be UN ambassador back in the day. Wasn't that kind of
the
whole
thing?
Yeah,
but she didn't have a role in the cabinet first, but still.
It was kind of the same vibe. Because I remember on the campaign trail, people were like, Trump, you had Nikki Haley in your administration, and he's just like, as a UN ambassador.
Doesn't
like,
really
it's not
count.
Like, that's basically what Trump said.
There's a bit of a conflict there, right? Because they're trying to pitch this that way. So if you have that memory, you know, it's there. I think within the circles of Washington, D.C., it's not. It's obviously not. Like, no one thinks it is, right? Because there is this... Everyone is shooting for the Game of Thrones here. Everyone is trying to get as close to the can as power. That's like the culture in D.C. When you're in D.C., being on the Hill is better than being in Foggy Bottom. Why? Because on the Hill, you're closer to decision makers. Even if at Foggy Bottom, you're actually setting policy, you're not setting the big policy, right? You're setting the smaller policies of implementation of code and law and the directives of the president. So from the very bottom, right, when you're very getting started to the very top, everyone is shooting for how close can you get to the major decision makers. And this is a long ways from that. And then second, to the deep state incentive, to frame the worldview of the president is a much more powerful position than to implement his agenda at the UN. So of course it's not a promotion, right? Of course it isn't. And no one takes that seriously within the outside the administrative talking points. That's kind of what it's relying here on. Glenn Greenwald took a screenshot of the New York Times post on this. On what is the real reason, you know? So is it ideology? Great question, right? And they're obviously pointing to this quote at the bottom. Most of Trump's advisors have already viewed him as too hawkish to work for a president who campaigned as a skeptic of American interventionism and eager to reach a nuclear deal with Iran and normalize relations with Russia.
So is that your thesis, that this is really an ideological split where he just doesn't align with the goals of the administration?
Yeah. Why did he get moved to a different role? It's a big question.
Yeah.
Well, right.
He was the guy that brought in the reporter on the Signal Gate.
Right.
The original Signal Gate. And he Good was point. The guy that had was all like super gung ho about bombing everybody. And J.D. Vance, even in the Signal Gate messages, like pushed back against. So like that's always something to kind of remember. Like everything's been aimed towards Pete Hegseth. Like they're really trying to get Pete Hegseth out, just like the war apparatus around them. But Mike Waltz was the guy that kind of started the whole thing.
Or allowed it to happen if it was, you know, his staffer or something like that. Yeah.
There's that. And then they still haven't caught, and there's some really great interviewing with Megyn Kelly and Tulsi Gabbard about this. On the later, after this, a leak to the New York Times based upon the conversations about the Iran situation. Mm-hmm. We reported on it. It's like this debate that was happening in the Oval Office between different factions arguing this. Now, Mike Waltz was very clearly on the same side as Rubio and what's his name? Outside guy. Mentioned him. It wasn't Wyckoff. No. He runs a nonprofit that's like super Iran hawk within in DC. Apparently he was there. So it's that might also be one of the reasons. It's like it was discovered that him or one of his staffers working on his behalf was the leaker. And this is just a way to deal with a leaker that doesn't have to go through the formal process and embarrass the administration for letting a leaker in.
Right, right.
Right.
So this is a gentle letdown for Mike Waltz and for the administration. Sort of just.
But it also ties. It also feels like there's a few different angles. Like it does make it feel like Trump still does value him in some regard, that it's not an outright firing. But there's also the sense where there's political repercussions of firing people in your cabinet this early too, especially when we've already had stuff like what's been going on in underneath Pete Hegseth and the firings that have happened in the staff there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like there's a bit of a political gamesmanship that could be playing here where it's just like, oh, let's just move him somewhere right. Like inconsequential. But
well, and weren't there quite a few firings in the early days of Trump admin number one? After
yes.
His first
a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So and that and the grappling with the deep state. Now J.D. Vance gives this like, you know, he did his reforms. He did the things we asked him to do. So we think he'd fit a better role over here. But what were those reforms? Well, apparently he fired some people and he gets to that. But there isn't like a lot of clarity about what really he accomplished in the role. So we're kind of left wondering what's the real reason at the end of the day, right? Because this does look like corporate HR talk.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It doesn't feel like we're getting the full picture here.
We're not firing That's you. Not. We're letting you go.
Yeah.
You're part of an outplacement.
We're going to move you into a new role.
We're not picking up your option.
Yeah, exactly.
It reminds me of the Emperor's New Groove. Any Emperor's New Groove fans out there, let me know in the comments.
All right. So, of course, Vance later denies that it's pure ideology, but let's dive into it.
I happen to agree with him.
But was it a direct result of the Signal chat? I mean, you were on that chat and we saw the fallout from it. Is this a result of that?
No, it's not, Brett. I mean, look, what we came into the administration, and of course, the president in his first term had some serious issues with the National Security Council. He said, Mike, you need to go in here, fire, frankly, a lot of people who aren't loyal to my agenda, who we think aren't even loyal to the American people, bring in the right collection of people to actually make the National Security Council function. And Mike has done that. And now it's time for Mike to do something else because he's done the job that I think he was asked to do. If the president wanted to fire him over the Signal thing, which, by the way, was a total nothing burger of a story, he would have just done it. But he actually decided it's better for Mike to be in this new role. He's given Mike the new role. That's it.
So what is the message to allies around the world? I mean, is Pete Hegseth safe at Defense Secretary? Are there other changes coming?
Well, again, I think certainly yes, Pete Hegseth is safe. And I think our cabinet secretaries, you saw yesterday the president, they're all doing a great job. On Pete in particular, I think the thing that is most underappreciated about Pete Hegseth and the great job that he's doing is we came in with the military with a serious morale problem. Recruitment and retention goals in most of the major services were way off. Pete has brought a certain esprit de corps. I think the leadership style has inspired a lot of people to join the military. We're now exceeding our recruitment goals. So yes, we've got total faith in Pete. But even the question, Brett, I think betrays a certain misunderstanding of what the goal here is. Mike Waltz is being moved from one administration job into a separate administration job where he has Senate confirmation. That's not, I think, what it's being framed as. That's the president deciding a guy who's a very good guy in Mike Waltz could do a better job at a different role.
Yeah.
So sorry, corporate.
Yeah.
Could do a better job in a different role. Right people, right seats. You know, it's very important. By the way, I love that J.D. Vance just used the term nothing burger. Like, way to go.
Yeah. Thank you. Who's that MSNBC commentator that popularized that?
I don't know.
Oh, man. It was...
It's just such universal internet speak.
I'm yeah, like, now yeah, it is. Nothing
he's
burger.
One of us.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that just in the administration in general of like people are okay with getting a little goofy sometimes.
Yeah, there's a bit of internet savvy that doesn't feel like it's been the norm until now.
Yeah, it was just like there was the like cabinet meeting that was going on and Elon came in wearing two hats and he said, I've always been a man that likes wearing two hats. Like there's like a goofiness, like a fun vibe that's not something that you normally expect in government anything.
Oh, true. That's true. And that's one of the things that we cited during the campaign about the campaign energies, right? That one side seemed like they were having fun. The other side was like manic.
I don't know. Did you see Kamala dancing this week? I don't have the video. I don't want to subject you guys to it.
I avoided it.
No.
But she gave her first speech that she's given, like her first big speech. So, and then she did some TikTok where she was dancing.
No.
She looked... you know, the wine mom thing is like
continues,
yeah, settling it continues. In.
She looks very drunk.
Really,
she's like slurring her words a lot.
It's reveling kinda, in her role as yeah. America's wine mom.
Mm-hmm.
I did catch the part where she was talking about the things she's been thinking about, which is these elephants at some zoo.
Okay.
She's thinking about elephants at the zoo. I don't really know the context, but that's what Kamala's up to these days.
Yeah, anyway. I know the press secretary and was asked about Kamala's speech, and she said, on behalf of the administration, we fully encourage Kamala Harris to continue to keep speaking.
Yep.
Reasons for leaving, number three. So you got Signalgate could be one of the ones, and blowback from that, just like subversive blowback. Second, you could have the New York Times leak. Could be interesting if it was that. But the third, this is my favorite, is perhaps he put a former Israeli Ministry of Defense employee on the Israel and Iran portfolio at the National Security Administration.
Oh, he did.
Yeah. Well, this was broken on Breaking Points, and it is contentious. But this is a tweet from Sagar Marav. Marav?
What's on Jetty?
Keep going.
Soren is a Middle East fellow.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
At the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, where she focuses on Israel, Iran, and counterterrorism policies. Previously, she worked at Israel's Ministry of Defense, where she participated in negotiations in the West Bank between Israel's coordinator of government activities in the territories and the Palestinian Authority officials. So, former Israeli defense person.
Now,
on the portfolio for American intelligence to prepare the briefing for the president to understand what's going on in the Middle East, with specifically the relationship to those two countries.
I don't know if this is something that I would expect him to get removed for.
What's the consequence of this?
Well, I mean, obviously it's going to drive. Okay, so if the core of your job is to get out of the people of the administration who are lying to the president in order to shape policy, people who are just going to stick with the facts and understand the president's policy and then give him the facts that he needs to make decisions according to his values, and you hire somebody who used to work for the countries that they're covering, perhaps you are not doing your job right.
Yeah, you may not be getting the most objective input from this person if they happen to be a, as it turns out, dual citizen.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are already, like, in the administration, in the executive branch, period, especially in diplomacy and in intelligence, if you have connections to another country, you are specifically forbidden from covering and doing work in that country because of concerns about dual loyalty. And those are old rules that go way, way, way back, like hundreds of years, specifically to avoid conflicts of interest and people getting co-opted by the countries that they're covering.
So this was, other than just maybe a strategic misalignment with the administration, sort of an age-old no-no in terms of something that you should and shouldn't do regarding national security.
Maybe. We don't have any evidence that it's actually this, but I like to, this is some dubious speculation, right? Yeah. I mean, it is a scandal. It is a real scandal. Like, it's not something to poo-poo in my mind because it is so clearly against the administration's perspective to go to war with Iran right now. I mean, we know about it. We covered it. BB had a plan with Biden to go in and do commando raids and actually air fights over Iran, you know, their batteries versus our airplanes, to take out nuclear facilities under the assumption that they're creating nuclear weapons. While the DNI candidate was saying, no, their current understanding of Iran's policies that they are not pursuing nuclear weapons. That's according to our intelligence agencies. Now, if you want to shape that, after that, the Israeli people were saying, no, you need to go back to the whiteboard, Tulsi Gabbard.
Do better intelligence.
Yeah, you didn't do it right because we know they are.
Interesting.
Right. Well, I mean, like it feels like Iraq, right? It's like you didn't come up with the right intelligence. Go back and do it again.
Yeah.
You didn't come up with the answer we already decided we wanted.
We know there are WMDs there. Yeah.
Right. Right. So, like, that dynamic is the set piece for this, of this person coming in and being part of that portfolio to prep his advice.
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't to me, I feel like this is something that would be the cause for Waltz to be removed. Like, I feel like there's someone here that obviously is probably biased in a certain, I don't know who this person is, so it's hard to actually like know what that, you know, what that person's all about. Like, I imagine there's probably going to be very pro-Israel and the Iran dealings that are going on here, but this doesn't feel like something that would be like the cause of Waltz being removed to me.
Yeah, totally fair. Yeah. But this is beyond pro-Israel. This is a person who is Israeli and worked for Congress and then worked for the Israeli defense.
Yeah.
According to her biography.
I get that. This doesn't feel like something that's going to be the thing, the straw that broke the camel's back. That's going to be the, like, I feel like this is just people that are very like Israel skeptical, just reaching for something. Yeah. That's what this feels like.
No, to be fair, I'm maybe stretching Sagar's claim a little bit, but yeah, it's definitely an interesting component to it, because if his job was to purge the deep state of people who are not supporting the president's agenda, and then he was bringing in people who were, you know, had a conflict of interest on the portfolio that they were covering, I mean, pretty much a problem. Fail.
Well, it seems clear that Trump wants a peaceful deal. Like, he's the force is always on the table, and like Tulsi Gabbard said that recently in her interview, but like, and Pete Hegseth was making like bold, like, we know where you are statements on Twitter to Iran recently too. But like, it seems very clear that that's the big stick for the diplomacy, right? But like, the goal here is, in Trump's mind, peace. Mm-hmm. Like, that seems very clear is what he's signaling. And Waltz is very much, let's take out Iran. Like, that is the vibe that he gives and kind of what he kind of stated in the signal chats too. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if he was just overstaffing with these types of people, like, I could see that being like, you're causing problems, kind of a thing. But to me, it's just, I'm not seeing necessarily the evidence here of what, like, this being a
major it might be a totality thing too, right?
This could be a variable in a larger theme that he was providing with the administration. I could see that being the argument, but
right. And so, and to go a little deeper on the Iran situation, especially in relationship to the Houthis, JD comes back around with Brett Baer on that question. And I think the way Brett Baer phrases this kind of shows the way that the Hawks are thinking about it.
You recorded your skepticism about launching a military operation against the Houthis on that signal chat. You were kind of overruled, if you will, about those concerns from the defense secretary and the national security advisor. And that open-ended bombing has entered its 48th day, 48 straight days of U.S. bombing. What does that say? Is the U.S. prepared to strike Iran based on what we're seeing with the Houthis?
Let me say a couple things, Brett. First of all, if you go back to when those messages were leaked, what we were doing is having a private strategic conversation about how to message this to the American people. It's always important to explain what you're actually doing, how to ensure that some of the, frankly, our allied countries that are underspending on their own defense are actually carrying some of the burden. That was a concern that I raised about this particular operation. But I wasn't overruled. What happened
That's
is the president...
Term. I'm sorry.
It's fine.
They expressed concerns that they won the day as far as the policy.
No, I think the president had made his desires clear, and our job is to implement it. And of course, part of implementing it is you talk about how best to do that, about when to actually launch a strike and so forth. And that's what the signal chat revealed. And frankly, you know, I thought it reflected well on me. I'm obviously biased about myself, but about Mike Waltz and Pete Hegseth, that we were deliberating how to implement the president's agenda. I think that's what a good national security team should do.
Okay, so what's
like,
interesting,
I don't care, it made me look good, so.
The internet loved me.
And to be fair, his role in that was, hey guys, maybe we should take some time and try to get Europe to do something before we do this.
And I would agree, that does make him look good.
Yeah. And what he didn't say is, hey guys, the Houthis are on our side against Al-Qaeda, maybe we shouldn't be bombing them, right? That's a little bit stronger position
for sure.
At least they were. Are they any more complicated? But
there's been a lot of shifting of sides in Yemen that have occurred over the decade.
Yeah,
exactly. But their authority to attack targets in the Middle East comes from two places. One, something that gives them the authority to attack Al-Qaeda and its sponsors, not attack Al-Qaeda's enemies, because Al-Qaeda's are Sunnis and Houthis are an obscure different
Zeta Shiites.
Yeah, Zeta Shiites. So why would they give the authority? Why would the 2001 authorization give them the authority to do that? And second, 2002 authorization is to invade Iraq. So how would either of those two authorizations give them the authority to attack Yemen?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, I'm not even sure that that's what the administration's appealing to. But a broader attack against Iran, who is also at war with al-Qaeda. Do you guys remember al-Qaeda ISIS attacked Iran a couple years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So which authority, wouldn't you need to seek authority from the president? Well, Thomas Massey asked that question on X this week and got just pummeled with pro-MAGA people saying, how dare you? You're grandstanding.
He's just going to be labeled with that forever now.
Yeah. Yeah. Like how could he possibly, like, I don't know, have questions about the authorization of the use of military force that the president's using to threaten another country? Like, you got to get a declaration of war to go to war with Iran, right? No?
Well, no.
Is that just how we do things now?
We don't do that anymore.
We don't do that.
That's what the old America was.
That's right.
You know? We don't do that anymore.
Take it easy, Woodrow Wilson.
It's a new world, David.
It's a new world, yeah. Like, what, we're gonna declare war? What is this, World War II?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the interesting things about this, too, is that a lot of this is conversations that should be happening in the public. That happened in the public because of leaks and happened in the public because of, you know, Mike Waltz adding people to group chats and stuff. Those sorts of things should be happening with the public saying, hey, what are the costs and benefits of going to war with Iran? What is the reason we should be going to war with Iran? You know what I mean? But instead they don't, right? Instead, these are all things that everyone is just assuming the president can just do on his own without Congress, and therefore we don't have to debate. And that's not healthy. That's not good. It should be happening on the level of the American people coming to a consensus on this, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, ideally. It is nice to see that it seems like the key players in the administration do not want to go to war with Iran. Like, they're willing to leave it on the table if necessary, which is how things should always be in diplomacy. Like, the very back end is always force. Like, that's kind of the deal of, like, all human relationships, is force is always kind of like the last thing that exists. So that is the same between nations. But it seems like there's a very clear agenda here of wanting to have some sort of stability in the Middle East and get these people to actually get along in some way. It's just a matter of, there's a lot of variables at play, and America is a key player, but they're not the only key player. And, you know, they got to kind of dance around certain things. So, like, peace isn't necessarily a guarantee. Like, even if the administration is 100% wanting to get to peace in this, but, you know, but there's also there's the unfortunate dynamic here of, when we're talking about the Iran nuclear program, is Israel does have nukes, and Iran always has to be concerned about that. And so, like, you know, there was a comment made about Iran no intelligence that suggests Iran is actually trying to pursue nuclear bombs. That's what was said during when Israel got their nukes too, is that there was no intelligence. All the inspectors came in and they couldn't. So, like, I don't know if you can necessarily believe that. There's probably some back end deals that are trying to be made. I know North Korea has kind of a partnership with Iran, and that seems to be a key factor in what Trump is trying to disrupt, is the North Korea connection there.
Well, the important thing to distinguish between is, we know that Iran has a latent nuclear capability,
yeah,
if they chose to pursue it, but they are not developing nuclear weapons. These are different sorts of categories. Now, remembering that we gave them nuclear technology in the Atoms for Peace program. And then when it was no longer our guy, the Shah, we were like, now you can't have nukes. And also noting, now when Bibi and the Israeli Defense League guy, who was just in town just like last week or this week, actually, coming in saying, no, we need a Libya option for Iran, yeah, right? Mm-hmm. Which is the biggest disincentive to actually get them to not develop nukes, because what you're saying is, give up your nukes so exactly. We can sodomize you to death with a sword.
Curvy sword. Oh.
It's not a laughing matter. I don't know why that's funny.
I just
remember I was in high school watching that happen. I was like, whoa, this is a crazy event. And it's like, as I'm becoming politically aware, I was like, whoa. I just watched a world leader get, oh, wow.
You watched it? There's a video?
Yeah, there was a video. Like, it was on, like, ooh, national TV.
Yeah.
That's so fucked up.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah, like the whole revolution of him getting dragged out and stuff. Yeah, it was crazy.
Oh, my God. Ew, David.
Kyle.
Kyle.
But, yeah, no, Yeah, it's just there's a lot of different variables in here, and especially because we're living in a world where nukes exist and nuclear proliferation is a thing. It's like this is always going to be this ambiguous thing that we have to like contend with mm-hmm. in some factor. So yeah. like
the question is how, right?
Exactly.
And what are the motives for Iran's hostility to Israel? Is it strictly dogma, or is it geopolitics with dogmatic overlays? Mm-hmm. What are the Houthis' incentives? All that kind of stuff. But before we get into that, because that's the next bit, I want to talk a little bit about your European thesis here, mm-hmm. right? So this wouldn't be a problem if, well, it'd be less of a problem, if Trump had not pulled out of the nuclear deal, right? Now we have this dynamic of J.D. Vance's...
I don't know if that's true.
Okay, well, yeah, hold on.
Contention.
So J.D. Vance in the signal chat thing basically says Europe should play a role here. We don't have hardly any trade that goes through this area. What are we doing? Right? Why not do this? So he knew that Trump had the directive at that time to do this, right? Of course he knew. How does he not know? Right? He knows that Trump has said we're going to attack the Houthis. But his role in the signal chat was to try to, I think, build consensus amongst the national security people in the chat to come back to the president and be like, wait a minute, I know you said that you want to do this, but if we wait, we can get more out of Europe. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So if Trump is trying to pull out of the nuclear deal in order to check the French connection to Iran providing nuclear fuel, what is the role? Why not wait on European action against the Yemen situation? Does that make sense? Like, if it doesn't seem singular purpose. Now, there are other variables, right? It could be like he more immediately needs to appease Israel for some reason. But you're still left wondering, like, if we wouldn't be here if he hadn't pulled out, right? The Iran nuclear deal under Obama was already had an inspection regime that is currently no longer existing because we pulled out. So what?
Well,
what's the deal?
So this is, I mean, the inspection regime doesn't, because you can hide stuff from the inspectors. Like, this is kind of the whole point, and this is what JFK was dealing with when Israel was developing their nuclear technology, is that, I mean, Israel was going through, like, the exact same thing that Iran is going through, where they're developing nuclear technology, but JFK is like, no, don't do that. But just like, we want to make sure that you don't have a bomb, because we don't want there to be one singular power with a nuclear bomb in the Middle East. And then the French were helping them develop a bomb. And they were just like, no, inspectors, you can't go in that room. And that room had the bomb. I can see that same thread probably just happening here. Like, so like there being inspectors doesn't really mean it. Cause we've seen countries go around the inspectors before.
Yeah, but we've also seen the inspector question that you're begging. Mm-hmm. Be the justification for an invasion of a country. And what I mean by that is not just Libya, but also Iraq.
Yeah, Iraq is the kind of that story too.
They accused them of avoiding inspectors all throughout the 90s to build the consensus that there were weapons of mass destruction. And then we went in and there are none. Mm-hmm. So what are we doing with here? Like, mm-hmm. is there any inspection regime you could be 100% confident in? Of course not. So what's going to happen? They cut a deal on nuclear weapons Iran, relieve sanctions, and then do what? Inspect.
Yeah.
They're going to inspect. And then the hawks are going to say, but the inspectors can't go everywhere. They can't go into the bathroom of the caliphate's, janitor's office.
It's written in the deal. Well, and this is the thing.
You know what I mean?
This is the thing too. Like, don't get me wrong. Like Iran's been 5 minutes away from a nuclear bomb for the last 30 years. Right? Like, mm-hmm. this has been the thing that we've been having to deal with. And every single time Bibi comes in and speaks to Congress, he's like, oh, and they're 5 years away. And it's like, you said that 20 years ago.
Yeah.
this is a never-ending thing that is constantly going. Like, to me, the best way to go about this is try to get Iran more friendly diplomatically with all the countries in the region and help facilitate that being a thing that can be done, mm-hmm. so that there's not this constant worry of threat, because they're constantly having to be worried that Israel is going to do something, and like they're always having to do this tit for tat back and forth thing just because of that relationship and how hostile it is, and with Saudi Arabia and all this, like it's a very complex environment there. So like, to me, it's like I feel like the Trump approach is generally correct, where it's like, we want to do whatever we can to make sure that there's not a nuclear bomb, like nuclear armed country happening in the region, while also like trying to bring them into the fold of everything else, right? Like that seems to be the correct approach. I don't know what a better approach is there.
Well, that we do have the question of like how to stop it in Yemen first, right? Because the administration has made a big point out of pointing out of the Iranian support of the Yemeni fighters and for the Shiites in the area. So let's dive into that, and we can kind of unpack the first step.
We're seeing signs that the Houthis are saying no mas. They've been bombed. They've recognized that there are serious consequences to firing on American and other ships. And I actually think we're in a good place for the Houthis to stop attacking civilian vessels, to go back to doing whatever it is they were doing before they were attacking civilian vessels. And I think that if that were happening, then this bombing campaign would be over the next day.
You hear the criticism, though, from libertarians, from the left,
sure,
that this is the new Vietnam. This is 48 days of bombing. People are in the middle of the country may not know, yes, that we're in the middle of a hot war with Yemen. What do you say to that?
Well, not with Yemen, with a terrorist organization
inside
that has been firing on American ships. And I think that people, you know, we want to compare this to Vietnam. Come on. I think that the president has made it very clear that one of his core national security priorities is that if you load stuff onto a ship and you send it to the United States, we want to make sure that it shows up without the sailors getting killed, without the ship being destroyed. That is an objective that we're going to pursue forcefully if we have to.
With this Mike Walsh change, and I know you say it's ascension.
I'm actually cut this beyond where we wanted.
Yeah. All right. So what is the Houthis' actual incentive? What is their motive? And it was interestingly alongside that claim that it will be over the next day, right? Like if the Houthis say no mas, or the Arabic equivalent of that. Kieran, let me know what the Arabic equivalent of no mas is. What will happen? Like they're going to go back to what they were doing before that. Well, what they were doing, to be clear, before we actually get into that, what they were doing, JD, before they were attacking American vessels, were being systematically starved to death and bombed by Americans.
Well, and a lot of the context behind that matters too, because it was in the aftermath of the Iran nuclear deal from Obama. The Saudi Arabia was big sad about it, and Obama specifically said, and this is on camera, that in order to placate the Saudis, we'll help you out with this whole Yemen situation. and then that's what kind of led up to everything that's going on there right now.
Right. And so like you have this constantly responding to the last thing we did, right? And how to break out of that cycle of constant response to the last thing we did. And that's why we're here in the first place. So what are they going to do? They have to change an underlying dynamic in removing their motive for, you know, being willing to die for a cause. Ultimately, right? Like that's how you got, I mean, remember this mental model I introduced when we talked about the Israel-Palestine? There's a tension between two different values that are important, justice and peace. And how do you elevate peace over justice, right? It seems like to me at least one of those things is to alleviate the underlying question of justice to a sufficient degree that people feel like they're dying for nothing, right? And then you desire peace.
Mm-hmm.
So Dropside News had a interview with Muhammad al-Bakhidi. He's a senior leader of Ansar Allah, which is the Shiite minority group that has been at war in a civil war. It's like three or four different sides in Yemen for some time. And the quote is, if you go down a little bit, Kyle, so we are suffering losses. We are also inflicting them for us. This is a moral battle we must fight no matter the cost. Silence in the face of genocide would mean the end of morality, humanity, and loyalty. Yemen's position should be an honor to all the people, all the free people of the world. So that's the question. Like their incentive for engaging in this fight at this point is no longer about, you know, Saudi domination over the Arabian Peninsula and the dynamics that they had fighting the Saudis and America's, like what you said, jumping in order to placate the Saudis. Placate the Saudis is literally what Obama administration said.
Yeah, that's like the exact quote. Yeah.
It's now about Israel-Palestine and that function. Now, keeping in mind that they've been pretty consistent about this, when the peace deal was cut at the very start of the Trump administration, they stopped. When Israel started to violate the peace deal by no longer allowing medical equipment and food in, as well as low-level fighting, they started up again. So if we stopped again, would they stop? Right? That's
so far, that seems logical.
Right? So they got to contend with that. And the administration just is not. Right? Additionally, JD kind of begs the question, if they just asked, we'd stop. But al-Baghdadi told Drop Tight News that if the U.S. ends its campaign of airstrikes against Yemen, Houthi forces will commit to halting all attacks on U.S. ships in the region. Quote, "We do not consider ourselves at war with the American people," end quote, said Mohammed al-Baghdadi, a member of Ansala's political bureau and longtime spokesperson for the Houthis. Quote, "If the U.S. stops targeting Yemen, we will cease our military operations against it." Now, remember that the Americans were sponsoring a proxy war in Yemen for a very long time. That was the number one world tragedy going up until October 7th in the Ukraine war. It was the number one way that people were dying in violence.
And also not covered at
all. So like the framing of, well, they just started attacking U.S. ships out of nowhere. It's a lot like Russia's unprovoked aggression against Ukraine.
Right.
Right. It's a time horizon fallacy. It just locks the time in into a very convenient narrative for you to justify your actions rather than actual understanding of the dynamic, which doesn't exactly place America into the role of we are always the good guy going out doing good things to defend trade around the world. That's just not true, right? Not in this situation.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure it's al-Baghdadi.
Al-Baghdadi.
You said al-Baghdadi a few times.
Oh,
which,
did I?
Which was the leader of ISIS.
My bad.
Abu Bakr.
Al-Baghdadi is dead. Died like a dog.
He is dead.
His name's Buhati.
Bugatti.
Bukati.
Bukaki.
Where's your Bukati?
Died like a dog. Yeah, just because different people. Like, because that was a very important figure. Yeah. And so I don't want people to like be confused. 100%. About this.
And
he's dead. So it was hard for him to give an interview.
Yeah.
From the grave.
And, well, yeah. Beyond my butchering of Arabic names, one thing to note, too, is this guy is spewing some bullshit, right? Like, they were attacking U.S. vessels prior to Trump had been coming into office. They've claimed that they're no longer attacking since Trump came into office. It doesn't really matter. Our policy in Israel is pretty much the same. But on January 15th, they did attack the MV Gibraltar Eagle in the Gulf of Aden with anti-ballistic missiles. So their idea being that anyone who's in the region is doing business with Israel, therefore they're a legitimate target. So they are... JD's not wrong in saying they were attacking peaceful vessels, not like military vessels. They're now claiming we're just attacking military vessels, but that's kind of like too little too late. Sorry. Like, right. Now we're there. So it's just begs the question. So what is the response? What should be the response to the Houthis?
Let's get out of all these Middle Eastern dynamics. Like,
yes.
Like we can't just full withdraw everything, obviously. Like, these things take time. Diplomatic efforts take time. We can't just be like, oh, see ya. But like, we should be moving out and getting more invested in our interests, I think, closer to home. That I think just overall, that is my general take. Like, let's help facilitate whatever diplomacy and negotiations of peace need to be done. But like, let's stop getting involved with these these small tribes. What are our interests in these things? It's nonsensical to me.
That's right. I mean, exactly, like, if it wasn't for U.S. support, there wouldn't be a war in Yemen, because the war in Yemen was closing down as the Saudis got injured enough that they just gave up.
You know, right? It's actually kind of Matt Walsh on Tucker Carlson this week. He made a statement that has kind of people on all sides freaking out, which is kind of funny. It's funny when there's a statement that makes like all sides freak out.
For sure.
Which was, he said something along the lines of, if you can't exist without U.S. backing, then you probably shouldn't even be a country.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's kind of where I'm at. It's just like, let these people figure it out on their own. And if one side can't accomplish what they need to do without us just pouring in billions of dollars and fueling the jets or something like that, then just like, maybe you shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah,
that's kind of where I'm at.
We're not even talking about, in this case, the existence of the state of Yemen or the state of Saudi Arabia. What we're talking about is, should North Yemen be its own country or not? Mm-hmm. With a different ethnicity and different demographics and all these other things that normally make up a consensus to make a country. That's what we're talking about here. And do the American people care who controls North Yemen, the poorest country in the Middle East?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure why I'm supposed to care.
Exactly.
Like, I get the human tragedy aspect, but it's like, to me, it's just, there's human tragedies everywhere. Like,
well, I mean, and the human tragedy is partially removed once you no longer have the U.S. using your tax dollars to fund the action.
Right.
Because if it wasn't for that, as we've seen, when the U.S. started to pull back from Saudi Arabia, it quickly ended. So let's just do that everywhere, right? And I mean, don't get me wrong. I agree with you, Kyle. Like, there could be enormous human tragedy to just pull back and not actually cut peace deals, especially because, you know, the Iran-Israel connection, what's going on.
Well, it's also because we've been so intertwined, I feel like there's almost a moral duty to be participatory in the negotiations of peace in these areas.
Yeah.
Especially as, like, you know, like, it's you know, we are kind of the policemen of the world, you know, as much as everybody hates to use that term. But there is that aspect there. It's just like, we have been so heavily involved. We should be a third party that maybe helps facilitate. But, like, a lot of the problems is that we're always one-sided in these. Like, we take a singular side because of this national interest or whatever. And it's like, well, we could be dealing, and our national interest is often energy. Like, it's often related to energy. It's like, well, we got a lot of energy that we could just be doing back domestically and with our trade partners to the north and to the south. And right. we could just shift focus there and stop all the dying.
Well, that goes back to the European thesis, right? It's because of Middle Eastern to European energy exports that were involved in the Middle East.
That's a part, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it's because that is one of those things. Is like, Europe wants to call it, like, this is a bigger piece of the picture. Is like, Europe wants to be a colonizer in the Middle East for the energy stuff because they have no energy at home, and so we are undercutting them often, and that is a piece of this. Because, like, if it wasn't us doing this, it would be Europe doing it. You know, it would be kind of the
we're
same
subsidizing
dynamic.
Their energy markets, assuming that we'd even need to do that. And the last part of that is Palestine and actually doing something about it that is acceptable to the people that we care about, to remove their core motivation for engaging in it.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that is the American interest, to the degree that we have one, is that we've been subsidizing Israel forever and setting up this dynamic where we are their partner and everything. And so everything they do then reflects on us. Mm-hmm. So but the things they're doing aren't necessarily in our interest. They're in their interests.
Which is why Iran states big devil, little devil, as what they call both of us.
Right.
Like, we're the big devil. Israel's the little devil.
That's
their view. Well, and this is kind of because the unfortunate nature of Israel-Palestine is it is very much similar to, like, America and the Native Americans, but just more generations have happened for America and the Native Americans, where it's like, I think the likely solution in the end of all this is something like Palestine being kind of like Native American reservations are on. But one of the problems is we treat the Native American reservations much better than they are probably going to treat the Palestine reservation.
Well, the challenge is you can't do that, right? Because that would be a single state solution, and then you're no longer a democracy because you can't give them the right to vote, right? What allowed the American reservation system to work was because Indians were a very small minority of the total population, so we could maintain the illusion of democracy. Israel can't do that, right?
And well, just the population difference. Yeah,
the question:
alone,
do they care? I don't think they do, right? And would they like a single state solution so that they can just dominate those people and not get them voting rights? Yeah, I think many in Israel would. I mean, at least the most hawkish people within Israel would.
Like, to me, the only real solution or a peaceful solution in the end is something like Israeli political leadership wants a change, and they get rid of Bibi, and a different party takes power that wants some sort of peaceful option. And then there's some sort of peacemaker on the Palestinian side that tries to turn the Palestinians away from Hamas and kind of the violent ends. Like, there needs to be like a Gandhi-like figure that appears on both sides for negotiations. And until that happens, this is just a never-ending conflict until somebody is wiped out.
But Israel has to move first.
Yeah.
The reason why is because they've been preventing an option within the Gaza, especially, for a very long time, right? Remember the Great March of Return? You remember that, Joe?
No.
Okay, the Great March of the Return was a relatively peaceful protest. There were rocks thrown. That's a true thing. That resulted in hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of people being shot.
Oh, I do remember this. Protesting. There was a documentary made about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The robo guns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, Kyle. Kyle's dark today. He's got a lot of dark humor. Canada goes down in flames, and he just comes in spicy.
Well, that is the thing. Maybe we can move. To the other American reservation, which is Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was my bingo card. Was
I pulled this for you, Kyle?
Oh, Canada, our home. Are they going to copyright us?
I got to say, this is public domain.
I don't know. Canada can be weird like that. I don't know. Oh, whoops. That's not what I wanted. Okay. Yeah. So what's happened in your... I had made the bingo card on our New Year's bingo card that there was going to be this landslide in the Canadian election. And that seemed like a good bet because all of the odds suggested that. All of the odds suggested that there was going to be a 120-seat swing for the Conservatives. Unfortunately, sad music. Unfortunately, so what we ended up seeing is part of the party dynamics. Don't be confused by the blue and red. Conservatives are blue in Canada.
Yeah.
Liberals are red in Canada.
Still confuses me, though.
Yeah. So what we ended up seeing was the Liberals picked up 17 seats and the Conservatives picked up 24 seats from where they were. In order to have the majority government, they need 172 seats. Liberals were three off from that. Now, part of the Liberal upswing was the New Democratic Party lost 17 seats. This is their progressive party. This is the AOC Bernie Sanders party.
So the left moderated and got more votes.
Yep. The left moderated, got more votes, collapsed the radical left into them. But what the expectation was that conservatives were going to be way over here on the chart. And that didn't happen. And you can even see this trend here that's interesting is the trend line of where people plan to vote for. Was conservatives were extremely high, and then just in the last few months,
it was right after the 51st state rhetoric started. That
that was a piece of it.
It's unfortunately there's not a vertical for Trump taking office because it was right when he took office.
Well, you can see Trump took office.
Yeah, Trump took office right here, right? So it'd be in this section.
Yeah, why does the decline start before then?
This is Trudeau leaving office.
Data.
This is Carney taking power originally, right?
Okay,
so. What we were supposed to have, so the way that Canada's election works is the prime minister calls the election, and but it had to be called before like October 20-something at the time, and that it was just kind of like, oh, when are we gonna have this election? And Trudeau was so unpopular. A lot of things, carbon tax credit was a major thing, just like a bunch of tax stuff was a major stuff. His inability to deal with Trump seemed like a big deal. All of these were factors. But then this guy Carney, who is quote unquote an outsider, he's never had public office. Outsiders would be a strong statement.
Talk, but, are you saying the World Bank guy is an outsider?
Well, it's not that he was the World Bank. He was. So here's who Mark Carney was.
Okay.
Mark Carney. So he worked at Goldman Sachs from 1990 to 2003. So Goldman Sachs career, worked in London, Tokyo, New York City, Boston, and Toronto. Like, and he was the co-head of Sovereign Risk, the executive director for emerging capital markets. Pretty big deal.
Globalist.
But then he became the governor of the Bank of Canada from 2008 to 2013 at the age of 42, by the way, like one of the youngest ever to do it. This is the Jerome Powell of Canada.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
Canada, out of all the G7 countries, navigated the financial crisis the best out of every G7 country. So he's looked upon strongly for this. He was one of the fastest to cut interest rates, at the time. Now some of this is when the Canadian oil boom was going on. So Canadian energy exports is probably what absorbed this more so than central bank policy.
Right.
But he played a role and people see him as playing a role. He then after 2013, went to become the governor of the Bank of England. So he became the Jerome Powell of England. After that, the first non-Brit to hold that position in 300 years.
Wow.
So this guy is like, he has had a career, right? He navigated during Brexit. He was the guy during that time. And strangely, he left March 2020. What an odd time to leave.
Yeah, it's very odd time to leave.
What do you mean by that? Why is it so odd?
Well, that's pre-COVID. That's the market crash for COVID. Like, he left the month of the market crash. Whoa. Right?
So well, it's just been a good run. See you guys. Yeah.
And then he goes into private investments after. Yeah. Like, of course, very just very curious. I don't know. But then he, when Trudeau resigned, he came in and overtook Liberal leadership, because you're voting for the leadership of, like, you're voting for the party who has their leadership position to be prime minister, right? So, like, he came in and took Trudeau's spot as Liberal leader with 85% of the vote.
And that's of the Liberal Party.
Of the Liberal Party.
Right.
When Trudeau resigned, which then made Carney the prime minister. So, like, when everybody was just like, well, what, why is Trudeau still in? They were going through this process at the time, and then Carney became the prime minister.
So is it partially the explanation is an incumbency advantage? That could play a variable, right? It's like reliability of someone who's already in office, already knows the job, that sort of thing.
I think there's a lot of people that didn't want to vote for the Conservatives, but they hated Trudeau so much that they were going to. And then there's this guy who Canadian media was kind of portraying as this banker rock star. Like, that's literally like kind of what they were calling him, is he was like this banker rock star. It's like, and he's this crisis manager that knows how to deal with crisis, and Canada's in crisis right now. So he's got this like proven track record of dealing with crisis. He also proposed and began cutting a lot of the stuff that people didn't like with Trudeau, things like consumer carbon tax. And he proposed a bunch of tax cuts on middle class.
The Liberals don't care about climate change anymore in order to maintain power. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, carbon tax or consumer carbon tax cuts.
Oh, okay.
Still on the businesses and stuff, right? So, like, it's very like the lower middle class, they're going to be getting the tax cuts, but the rich aren't, right? So that's
progressives now understand how cost shifts work. They understand in tariffs. Why wouldn't they understand it with a carbon tax?
It's inconvenient.
Well, these were the five core promises. Tax cuts, disrupting a lot of the capital gains tax hike. Getting rid of capital gains tax hike that Trudeau put in there too. And then just general tax cuts across the board for lower and middle class. Trade diversification, because 75% of their exports are the United States. Mm-hmm. Streamlining regulatory approvals for energy and mining products. Positioning Canada as clean and conventional energy superpower. So for both conventional and clean, right? These are the neoliberals of Canada. Like, that's like, these are the Hillary Clintons of Canada.
This is just to show you. Everybody runs as a libertarian, then governs like
negotiate new economic and security relationship with the United States. People see him as being the most likely to be able to do that, to be able to navigate this way more than Polyev. And it's kind of funny because Trump kind of tweeted this out too. No, he said this in an interview where he felt like he could work with Carney better than he could work with Polyev. And then social and environmental commitments. They can't get rid of these.
I take back what I said.
Social handouts, capping emissions, et cetera. Those are still part of the agenda. Uh-huh.
But how do you accomplish that without the carbon tax?
Consumer carbon tax. Right?
Got it.
So this is kind of the dynamic at play. We have, although that being said, with all this, the Conservatives did get 41% of the popular vote, which is their highest since Harper, so 2011. So they did get a higher popular vote than they have been getting. It's just they didn't get the seats. They won seats, but they didn't get the government control. Now, there's a broader conversation, and this is where the internet has really erupted on this conversation now, is that we have, so this Polyev guy, people have probably seen him. Even if you're American, you probably saw this. It's like, oh, Canada's getting, like, he was very popular during the trucker event and stuff like this. They're like, oh, he's like the next Trump. But, like, everybody's just saying that. Like, nobody's looked into him. Nobody knows anything about him. People are just saying he's the next Trump. He's positioning himself like the next Trump. Mm-hmm. He's been a politician since he was like 22. Like, he's not like this outsider. He worked for the Stephen Harper government, which Stephen Harper was better than Trudeau. Like, and he was the conservative leadership at the time. But he didn't do any major media appearances. He stayed confined to the media within Canada, which is state run. So he's like,
you know, in their frame.
Yeah. Everything's within their frame. He didn't take hard stances on immigration. He's just like, I'm just going to be slightly better than Trudeau was. Like, that's basically his position.
On immigration? That would be so easy.
Yeah. You would think so.
Yeah.
Right.
So you think he botched the job?
Yeah, he botched the job.
He was never who they said he was, and that's one of the reasons why he botched the job.
Yeah, because he's like a Mike Johnson character. He's like a nerd.
He looks like Mike Johnson.
Yeah. He's like, actually, let me just pull up a picture of him.
Yeah, so I want to see the nerd vibes.
Poliev.
Vibe check.
Fit check. Probably wearing a suit. Nothing to talk about.
Did you notice that Hegseth had a camo tie in one of his things there? That was
kind of cool.
Yeah, I see it.
Some glasses on that guy. It's Mike Johnson.
It's a class present.
Is that
a one of those joke flowers that squirts water? Clowns wear.
Here's him with glasses.
That's Mike Johnson.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, he's kind of got that vibe, right? And the thing is there was a major contention for Canadian leadership back 4 years ago or so. And it was very close. Poliev got 51% of the vote, and Maxime Bernier got 49%. And Maxine, who was really kind of like the Trump candidate, went and started his own party.
Oh.
So there's also that. And they didn't get any seats. They're a new party. But he's kind of the anti-immigration, anti-legal immigration guy, like working, having good relationships with the United States. He's like that guy. And he's been making media appearances, like going on American podcasts. He went on PBD. He went on Tucker Carlson. He went on these, where all of these people were offering Poliev a seat in like American podcasts. And there's like, no, it's American. We're not going to do that. It was like, Canadians listen to podcasts too, bro.
They're in English.
but like the campaign, the rhetoric that the campaign was giving the podcast hosts were things like, oh, we're worried about how the liberal media will frame it if we do this.
Oh,
it's like, okay. If he went on Joe Rogan, it was like, oh, he went on Joe Rogan.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, what do you do? Like,
yeah, he's running like it's 2001.
They're going to frame it poorly like, anyways, because you're not on their side.
Yeah, it's just like an establishment approach. It's like super risk averse, skeptical of new media and how it's going to be framed by the larger public because they think the larger public doesn't listen to new media now.
Yeah, like the only podcast appearance he's done is with Jordan Peterson.
Because he's Canadian?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all he's done. And that was like a couple of years ago. So that wasn't even on the lead.
Wasn't even recently.
And this was the thing too, was he wasn't even we all knew that the election was going to be happening. He didn't start campaigning until like a few weeks ago.
Why?
Yeah. Because like the election hadn't been called yet. Like, so he didn't start campaigning. So he kept a bunch of his policy positions secret.
Yeah.
Into that point. And just like, bro.
Yeah.
Like we all know you're running. Like, what are you doing?
And at least, so that's like a following the rules thing. Is it illegal to campaign before?
I don't know.
It's called
it might just doesn't matter.
Like you're not campaigning, but everyone does this. If they do it in America, with it comes to like officially declaring your presidency, as people will go out and they'll start talking. They'll release a book or whatever.
Yeah,
and they'll do a media tour. Does this guy's cons person just suck?
I think that's some of what it is, and it's still just being very confined. So here's a Chris Pavlovsky, who is the CEO of Rumble. He tweeted out saying, "I tried to arrange Pierre Poliev to meet Donald Trump Jr. at a Rumble live event in Toronto last year. While the liberals attacked and illegally attempted to shut down our event, Pierre Poliev refused to even engage or meet Don Jr. This is not what winners are made of." Like, this is the type of stuff. It's like, you have the son of the president that wants to come, of America, of the empire, that wants to come promote you. And there's like a lot of people, especially in like the Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba realm, which is very conservative. There's a lot of people that want to see you succeed and have a prosperous Canada with like conservative policies. Like, there's a lot of people here that want to see that.
There's like the meme energy of that, and they're just completely ignoring it because this reeks of me of like traditional communications, corporate communications ways of thinking about how to do what you're doing, right? Because it's like this whole, if the mainstream press doesn't like it, it's going to make us look bad, right? If the everyday people who are not engaged don't understand our perspective on this, then they'll see us with Don Jr. and they will, you know, think that we endorse everything Trump believes in.
Well, right. And I wonder if there's an element of it there where, you know, especially after the 51st state rhetoric started flying around, that Trump became extremely unpopular in Canada. They didn't want to be tied to that brand for going on all the same American podcasts that Trump did that won him the election. So maybe they were just really trying to distance themselves from the Canada's Trump energy.
Well, that's dumb, because in order to get to the people who heard that rhetoric, you have to actually go talk to them.
True.
Right?
True.
That's the problem. Like, the entire model is built around the idea that new media isn't relevant. And it is. right? And it has its own audience. And those are the audience that you actually need in order to win elections as a populist from the right.
So who's the insurgent conservative candidate? Is it Maxime Bernier that's going to be like the guy who will embrace this and maybe take up the mantle of the conservative movement?
Well,
the
problem is that he's not in the conservative party anymore. Like, he's a former MP that was big in the conservative party, and then he lost the leadership with 49% of the vote, and then went and started his own thing.
But he didn't pull 49% of the vote with him to his new thing.
Exactly. Yeah, that's and it is kind of like libertarian Republicans who don't like the Republican Party and then are on the libertarian, like, it's the same vibe. All of the same factors are happening there, you know. And
well, despite having a parliamentary system, it seems like Canada is more like America when it comes to the two major parties really being where all the action's at.
Yeah, because the Liberal Party France and the NDP, and yeah, the Liberal Party and the NDP still work together all the time,
right?
And they're a coalition with each other, which then brings them over that threshold. Mm-hmm. Because like right now, the Liberals are three seats under, but like they're still. Right. The NDP still has seven, so that like with them they go over. Mm. Right. But
who's the barbecue party?
That's Quebec.
Burger Queen.
Burger Queen.
This is all the Quebec separationists.
And they're like, also
everything is all Quebec. We only care about Quebec. That's all we care about.
Okay.
Right.
Nice. I like them.
And then this is the Green Party.
Yeah, right. So Canada's just liberal. That's what we're finding out. The Liberals really weren't willing to move over to conservative. Is that all right? Am I right there? Is this ultimately they just weren't able to persuade enough Liberals to switch parties?
Well, and here's...
There's no, there are other votes there. Or get more turnout for conservatives. If the guy wasn't inspiring, the conservatives didn't show up to vote, then that's another explanation.
Well, like, and the thing is, they did show up to vote. Like,
where turnout's good.
They got more of the popular vote than they've had in over a decade. So, like, they did get that. It's just the seats didn't translate.
Well, and the Liberals got more. If they also saw an increase in turnout because they weren't demoralized because what's-his-name was out, Trudeau's out, and because, you know, Trump bad and mean, if they're hearing that on their public, you know, television every single day, that'll inspire more people to come out and vote.
Well, and hearing that on the television every day is what is interesting to me, because especially when it comes to – I got this graph sent to me, which was – care about issues based on age. And when you think about age, just think about older people are watching the state-sponsored media way more than the young people are.
You can see where that establishes itself in this chart.
If you see on this chart, and sorry for the audio-only listeners, but you have everything spread 18 to 29, 30 to 44, 45 to 59, and 60 and over. And dealing with Donald Trump is a 50% of people 60 and over, this is like their biggest issue.
Oof. More important than reducing cost of living.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you also just look at it as improving Canada's healthcare system is them. So
growing
it's their socialized
the
medicine. making housing affordable, 60 and over, they don't care.
Yeah, well, they do not care. Yeah.
But the young people really care. Right?
I love making Canada a better place to live. They're like, I don't care. Yeah, I'm not going to be around.
But
so.
Donald Trump said mean things.
Isn't that
way more important?
Isn't that crazy? 18 to 29, they really, they actually care quite a bit about making Canada a better place to live. And it's like 5% of 60 and over that care about that. Like, it's just like, we're done. We don't care. Which doesn't that just, we did the skiff episode on the assisted suicide like the thing. Yeah. And it was like, doesn't that just tell you everything right there? It's just like, they're
I
just like,
gonna say it,
we partied it. We partied it up and we're done. We don't really care about the next generation anymore. Like, that's the vibe that's happening here with Canada. And like, we say that in American politics about the boomers all the time, where like young people kind of feel that way about the boomers. It's like in Canada, that feels like to an extreme.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. Like,
seriously.
It's like the worst stereotype of the boomer, right? It's like coming across the millennial that's, you know, sitting in his footy pajamas eating avocado toast. This is the equivalent of that, right? Like, no, I don't identify with that millennial. And, you know,
maybe
no,
it's
none of the boomers
you,
I know.
If you drank fewer $5 lattes. Huh?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. This is that. Holy cow. In a graph form, can you imagine caring when 50% care 50% more about what Donald Trump is doing than making your home country a better place to live, much less caring more about protecting public services than making housing affordable. I mean, God.
Yeah, they don't care about growing the economy.
It seems like a pretty selfish electorate, to be honest.
It's so, like,
wow.
this chart is so wild to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, because specifically the question itself was which two of these are most important in deciding how you will vote. So everybody that got surveyed with this, they chose two things on here. Yeah. So dealing with Donald Trump was 50% of the survey takers. They said that this was one of their top two issues.
And it probably isn't thought through, but this is where their emotional state's at. And that's where the voting happens, right, is on the emotional level. So if that's – and that's part of it. If it's the public state media and all they're doing every day is saying how Donald Trump's going to end the world, well, you're an old person who does nothing but consume that. You're going to be like, hell yeah, that's exactly – I got to keep the – who cares if Canada has a great economy if the world ends when Fair. Donald Trump – takes us and makes us a 51st state or whatever.
Well, and speaking of 51st state, I do want to just, because there's a lot of this talk that's going on online, is the is looking at the Alberta secession movement. And so to give that dynamic of where Alberta is oil, like oil central for Canada. Mm-hmm. Saskatchewan also has a lot, but Alberta is the place for oil. Conservatives won 34 out of 37 seats in Alberta. So this is how, like, Alberta is the Texas of Canada. Mm-hmm. Then in places like Edmonton and Calgary, we had, I think the Liberals picked up two seats and the NDP picked up one seat. So, like, that's kind of the spread that existed there. Mm-hmm. The day after the election, there's this bill, it's called Bill 54, that is likely to pass, but it was put through and it's being put through for consideration in the Albertan government. Inside of it, it lowers the signature threshold needed for referendums to be brought to the table from 20% of eligible voters down to 10% of eligible voters, which is about 175,000 people. Mm. This is something that makes it much easier for the Albertans to challenge the feds. Things like bringing secession movements to the table.
Hmm. So interesting.
10% of eligible Alberta voters. Polls in Alberta show that 30 to 41% support independence in Alberta. The rural side really loves that, but yeah. Edmonton and Calgary, which are the two urban centers, they want federalism. Mm-hmm. I think this plays a picture into the larger geopolitics of what we're seeing here. Because like I had mentioned when talking about Carney here, is when the financial crisis happened, the energy exports from Canada really absorbed the hit there. So like Canada is the largest place in the world when it comes to like oil. Like they have so much, but they're stuck with this mine virus here. And Albertans are being kind of strangleholded here, where back in 1980, and this is still in effect today, Daddy Trudeau, Justin Trudeau's father,
Fidel,
Papa Trudeau, when he was the Prime Minister of Canada, because this is a dynasty family, he put in place what is called the National Energy Program. And what this forced is that all provinces had to equalize their profits, it being paid out towards Ottawa. Ottawa is the Washington, D.C. of Canada. In order to provide for comparable public services to each other, so that all the provinces had kind of the equivalent public services. What this resulted in is they have to like equalize their profits. In Canada, they supply 85% of the oil in Canada. Hmm. Alberta is the richest province because of oil. Hmm. This required Alberta to pay 20% of the total for everybody's public services when they only have 11% of the population.
Mm, really?
Yeah. So this is the dynamic of the secessionist movement, right? Like it's a very, and that being said, it's also like the Western provinces pay more for public services than the Eastern provinces do. So you have this West versus East dynamic that is at play here. And it feels very much like America, where it's like everybody feels like they're just like paying for the cronies in Washington and kind of all these like elitists here, when it's like the people making all the money in the center of the country, who are the agricultural center of Canada, who are the oil, like the energy sector of Canada. They just feel like they're paying for like the slush fund that is public services for everybody else, right? Mm. And this is what Alberta is trying to remove themselves from. This is why Alberta is so, and this is where the 51st state rhetoric is like part of the polling is that they would be down either for independence and working with America or joining America, right? Like this is the and we're talking 30 to 41% support this.
I for one would welcome Alberta into the United States.
A lot of oil.
Yeah,
now up for Department of Environmental Quality and approval.
Well, they're going to be grandfathered in.
Yeah.
Now, it is.
If we adopt their land use policies, that would be awesome. The trick is that they'd have to adopt ours, which wouldn't be great because they reformed theirs in the 90s, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident about that.
No, it is funny. So I had a friend send me something, and it was literally, he literally messaged this. I literally can't pronounce any of these people's names. And it was a screenshot of something from one of the elections. I think it was in Southeast Edmonton. So I want to pull this up and you guys can see. And this also just goes into play. Remember our coverage of Ireland? And it's just like everything in Ireland is changing. Like nobody's actually Irish in the government. Like, yeah, you know, it's like becoming that. Just get this feel right here. So Joe wanted to do something where he wanted, David, he wanted you to try to pronounce all these people's names. Oh,
okay. Yaksharan Sia Mahala. Amajarit Sohi? Sohi? No?
Keep going.
Yeah, okay, all right. Harpreet Grewal. Harpreet. And then Martin Schweza. I don't even know how to do that one.
Now, so you'll notice in a lot of these elections, you'll notice in a lot of these elections where it'll be like, and it's like, because when people think of Canada, they don't think of a very diverse place, right? It's not super diverse.
It's like Toronto, either you're
French Canadian or not French Canadian. That's what I think a lot of people's minds are in that. But you'll just see across the board, like all this is just like everyone's wearing turbans. Everybody's like, this is the conservative winner in Edmonton.
Nice.
Right? He's got a nice turban there.
Yeah.
Jag Sharon, right? And this is in Alberta, right? This is Alberta.
That's how you pronounce the name, Jag Sharon?
I don't know. But
Jag Sharon? Singh Mahal?
Jag Sharon?
Yeah. That's probably how I'd say it.
Yeah.
But this is the feel that Canada has where it's like, okay, you have all these Canadians who are like what you would expect to be Canadians. And then like all their leadership is like not what you would expect of Canadians. It's sort of like down in Mexico. It's like all the leaders is like Mexico is a Catholic country, but like all of the people in leadership positions are like these like atheist climate scientists and stuff like that. You're like,
yeah, who's the president now?
Mexico? It's like, this is the feeling that a lot of people are having in Canada. We're just like, What is that? It's like when we covered Ireland, it was like the same way where you're same like, way. this isn't even an Irish dude. You're like, what is happening here?
Yeah. I mean, right? There is a historical trend for minorities to run for official positions in order to legitimate themselves as a minority, right? The Irish did that by taking, you know, police chief roles and stuff like that, and then working their way up the political system until Kennedy. So I think it's that, but it's also a strange thing, like our obsession in the West with diversity, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people will vote for somebody. People I know and respect and love will voted for Barack Obama because he was a black guy.
This is a historic moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's that sort of value set as well.
Well, it's just because like,
but that does have a blowback. And what you're citing is the blowback of that. It's like people are like, wait a minute. Now everybody who's, you know, doesn't share the same sort of cultural background I do when it comes to this. Now, maybe these guys are super Canadian and they've just been there for a long time or whatever. They just got an Indian name. But it's people operate on the meme. They operate on the sight, the feel of something. And, you know, you get the screenshot, you can see people in Canada being, I don't know how to pronounce my leader's name. You know,
like and that's the thing is like I would actually expect to see more people like this Martin Schweitzer guy.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of what I would expect. Like still names you can't really pronounce because that's like the French side. Ugh.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. Right. But like, you're just like, but I get it. Like,
but his first name's Martin, East, right?
Yeah.
Right. Like,
right?
Yeah.
Marty. Well,
like that's cause so I had a friend send me this and I was just like, yeah, that kind of is everything that you, yeah, that's kind of what Canada is right now. Where it's just like, this has all happened really quickly. It's like in the last decade, all of a sudden it's just like all the leadership positions are just being filled up with not what you would expect from previously during like the Harper government, which is like all the leadership positions. You're just like, wow, like there's a lot of turbans in parliament right now. Like what is happening?
Yeah.
Like it just should be kind of like shocking. You're like, wow, is that a big change, Kyle?
Are you racist? Is that a problem?
No, it's more so this thing where you're like, something changed here. And a lot of it is the mass immigration stuff. Like you have people just being flooded in into the country. And the Arab population in Canada, specifically in places like Toronto and Ottawa, is like skyrocketing.
Arab or Indian?
Difference. There's a difference there.
Arab and Indian, actually.
Okay.
And also Ukrainian. Like a lot of Ukrainian immigrants in Canada.
Which just the Nazis. Just the Nazi ones.
Yeah, just the Nazi ones.
Remember the ones that they applaud in
Parliament?
Yeah, applaud those guys.
Yeah, that guy's been there for a minute. Yeah. But yeah.
But yeah, no, it's kind of a weird thing up north here. And to me, it's actually the more I studied into Mark Carney, who won the who is the prime minister right now. Part of me, it was also kind of like, I kind of get it. Like, I kind of get why Canada went for him because of who he was in the background and because of Poilievre just kind of like cowardice. Like, Carney seems like a much stronger man, actually. And I think people flooded towards that, despite it's like the conservative policies would, in my opinion, be much better for Canada.
Right.
But we did see the liberals moderate, which is what in America it seems like the liberals need to do and they're probably going to do, right?
Right, and maybe the Liberal Party saw what happened to the Democrats in their election, in our election, and said, "Hey, we can't do that same thing. We got to dial back the extreme rhetoric and do some things that the people actually feel are helpful to their lives."
Yeah, and the rewinding of the clock. If Trump hadn't become president, would we see a much more conservative Canada at that point? Like, what is the Trump variable there? Because the Liberals might not have moderated.
So.
And then you wouldn't have the 51st state phenomena. But you're kind of saying...
I think Trudeau still would have resigned. Yeah. And we still would have... So my understanding, too, is the Liberals have been trying to court Carney for the past decade, actually. Mm. So he did come in while he was doing private investment stuff for the last 4 years during COVID. He did come in recently and become like an economic advisor under Trudeau for like cleaning up the COVID mess. Mm. So he was already kind of there, and the Liberals have tried to court him in the past when he went off to be the governor of the Bank of England. Hmm. So he's been a known entity that people on the Liberals' side liked, but he's just never been a actual politician before.
Right.
He was always this finance guy.
Interesting. So you feel like that variable is stronger than the Trump and the election variables in the Americas. And that could be my American lens, right? I just assume that everything happens because America, you know, is a variable, right? But it might be weaker. It might be internal dynamics are stronger. Or that Poilievre just botched the campaign, right? I mean, just didn't show up.
Yeah, I think it's both. Like, I think Carney actually was a good candidate.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like in America, I'm saying that in a sense of, if there was a neoliberal person that ran for the Democrats that was extremely charismatic, like, I would say that's a good candidate. That's like who they should run. Yeah, like Mark Carney was like, oh, yeah, he's the guy they should run. He's kind of the fix to the liberals in Canada right now because he moderates. He's seen as having like a very steady hand, especially from his time. Like, that's the rhetoric around him. Like, he had a very steady hand and he was like very good with crisis management. And that's what Canada feels like they're under right now is crisis. And it's like, oh, we have like a successful guy in the room that can handle these problems. Like, that's the sentiment that I'm getting from him. And then it's amplified by the media because he is like a World Economic Forum guy. And he is like, he is that guy.
Right.
Canada's not changing from the cultural milieu that they've been under. It's just now they're just like, we're not going to go as far as Trudeau now.
Yeah.
Like, right.
Yeah, just taking a couple step back from Trudeau.
We'll cut some taxes for you guys. Like, we got a guy that understands economics. he's got a doctorate from Oxford in economics. Like, that's the vibe, right?
Yeah. But I guess, according to Jordan Peterson, he's a big ESG guy, you know, stuff like that.
That was a big thing when he was at the governor of the Bank in England is trying to help embrace environmental soundness to the finance sector.
Yeah, so we're going to see more of that stuff. So it's going to be Trudeau, too, just a little slower. You know, rather than going 60, we're going to be going 45.
Yeah, but it's also one of these things. So on the trade stuff, because like this is the curious thing to me is Trump kind of quasi-endorsed Carney, and then on the election day in Canada, he gave this very neutral, like, I hope Canadians get who they want and didn't support anybody. And that's a very curious thing to me. And I think a lot of it comes down to he actually thinks he can work with Carney better than Poilievre. I also think that there's a connection here where I think that there is a connection between Besant and Carney because of their finance time in London.
They're buddies.
Not that they're buddies. They didn't work together. They were in London at... Besant had a brief stint at Goldman Sachs in the London office while Carney was there. Carney would have been very privy and understanding. He was working in London throughout all the aftermath of breaking the Bank of England during Soros Management Fund and Druckenmiller and Bessent's role in that. And it's just like they would have brushed shoulders a bunch in there. Sure. So like there probably is some like repertoire that exists there that's kind of interesting to me.
So the way I was interpreting it is that Trump would rather have an adversary in Canada so that he can conduct his trade war with the maximum amount of like pushback and drama to create the friction that he needs in order to set up the new arrangement that he wants. Mm-hmm. Although I don't really understand what that is with Canada, because of the oil and other imports are so big.
There's some similar speculation. We'll go dubious speculation here. From posts that I've seen on X that allege that there are some familial ties between Carney and Trump, because Carney had a role at Brookfield Asset Management. And these posts claim that Brookfield's $1.1 billion lease deal with Jared Kushner's family could give Trump leverage over Carney. We will find out. Mm. The claim suggests that Trump might prefer Carney over a stronger Canadian nationalist like Poilievre, because you know maybe a weaker Canada aligns more with you know his interests. So
And that type of stuff is exactly what I'm thinking of, where Trump thinks that he could work with Carney better, because it's like this is a theme with the Trump administration is you have all these people like who actually understand how like markets and things like that. They worked in markets, like they're not like politicians who understand markets, quote unquote, right? Like these are people who actually have made all of their money in markets and kind of understand how these dynamics work. And you have all these touch points of within these elite factors of these people kind of like they're in a similar club in a sense. And I think that when you look at it, it's like Poilievre is just another politician. Like it's not Carney's not just another politician. Poilievre is just another politician.
Sure.
In reality, like that's when you just put it down to the bare bones of it, that's kind of the dynamic at play. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whereas like with Carney, you have a guy who like actually has existed in the world beyond politics.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
I think that's a major player. And if there's actual financial ties in something with like Kushner and stuff like that, that's another touch point that exists.
Right.
Right.
There you
absolutely
go. All right,
fellas, another wonderful episode, a little long. Thanks for hanging out with us, everybody. We appreciate you. Please do join the Discord and drop us a comment. Do you think Canada is going to be better off under Mark Carney than it was under Trudeau?
I don't know about that.
What do you think the fallout's going to be from all of this? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Help us juice the algorithm. Smash the like button. If you're watching us or listening to us on Spotify or Apple or anywhere else, please leave us a review. We appreciate it very much. For David Rand and Kyle Mack, I'm Joe Sheehan. See you in the next one. Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.